Hello, everyone. My name is Tara Montazeri. I am a registered associate marriage and family therapist, and you are listening to Trust and Thrive. On this show, we will discuss topics related to mental health, relationships, generational healing, systemic issues, and other topics that influence us in our everyday lives. Although the show is not a replacement for therapy, I hope the conversations shared can inspire you to stay curious, to self-reflect and practice self-compassion, and to find support in community. You can follow along on Instagram at Trust and Thrive, and stay tuned for new episodes released every Thrive Thursday. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you enjoy the show. Now let's get right into this week's episode. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Trust and Thrive. So in honor of the first week of Mental Health Awareness Month, I wanted to throw it back to some past episodes and put together different clips from episodes where we specifically talk about different diagnoses. I try to gather different episodes related to different topics, and that may include ADHD, OCD, depression, different topics. And like I said, I'm simply sharing very short clips from these episodes, and these are such complex topics. So please remember that even though these are professional speaking, these short clips cannot take into account every single aspect of these very, very complex topics. So that being said, I hope you enjoy. I am just going to share the episodes, have a little transition in between them. But if you want to know specifically which episode it is and the name and title of the episode, I will include that in the show notes of this episode. So if anything resonates you, if you want to listen to the full episode or listen again, if you already have, just simply visit the show notes and I'll have all the info there. I hope you enjoy. And as always, it's always an important time to acknowledge our mental health, to take care of ourselves. And hopefully this month is just a reminder of that. You can find me at Trust and Thrive on Instagram and TikTok. That being said, I hope you enjoy this episode. Let's get right into it. And what advice would you give to someone who maybe they're in that situation and, like I said, they have people disregarding it or saying get over it, and they feel like, you know, they feel shame for it or they feel like it's a weakness to even reach out for help?
Well, the best advice, so something my dad told me growing up, he would always say that prevention is the best cure. And this is why I believe that something like therapy is essential for everybody. And I talked about this. I spoke about it on my TikTok, you know, when I went to therapy for the first time. I mean, it was weird being on the opposite side of things. And, you know, even my therapist was like, why are you here? Because, like, I know the answers to everything. You know, it's kind of like taking a test where you and your friend cheated beforehand and you know what to do. But I was just telling her, I'm like, you know, I want to be more self-aware. So I want to figure out what habits do I have that are not productive to me? What can I do to be preventative? You know, the same way we go to the doctor and we get a checkup and go draw a lab and say, okay, based off of the labs, you might need to lay off on the sugar because you could become diabetic. Then because you know that, you switch up your diet and you avoid having diabetes. So I see mental health to be the same thing. Prevention would be the best cure. Now, you don't have to necessarily go to therapy, but talk to friends, talk to people around you. Ask them for the honest input. Like I'll tell everybody, I'll tell my brother, like, where am I messing up? What can I do better? What am I doing that right now that's effective? Because I want to be very self-aware because I know that I'm in control of my life. And a lot of times when people are depressed, it's funny, the way they speak, it'll be more passive. Like, they have given up control of their life. They'll say, oh, because of this, I can't do that or I can't do this. Like, their mindset is not very, you know, active. It's more of passively attributing everything to their environment. But when you empower yourself, you give yourself the strength to keep moving forward. But the best thing I would say is prevention. So try and be more self-aware. And also at the same time, if you really feel like you've got to that point where you need help, I would reach out. And I would do the most simple thing at that time. So if you really feel like you're clinically depressed, I wouldn't say, start scrambling online for how to find like a psychiatric provider. Now, that's the answer, right? but you might not have the energy to even get to that point. So if you can just wake up and take a shower, go outside and get some, you know, fresh air, that will give you momentum to maybe call a friend, have a conversation. Somebody is oppressed and they'll wake up and they'll go on the computer, go to Psychology Today and find a counselor or find a psychiatric provider. And that order, it doesn't really happen like that because they don't have the energy to seek out, you know, help. So most likely it's best to simplify things. Do one simple thing that can give you some momentum to get the help that you need.
There's so many misconceptions and ways that disorders are misused. So I appreciate you giving that example. And so now can you define obsessions and compulsions? Because I know a lot of people have heard of OCD and they may not even know what it stands for and what obsessions and compulsions necessarily mean.
Oh, of course. And I appreciate the question because just the term itself, obsessions, people get that confused with obsessing as in like, oh, I'm obsessed with makeup and I'm obsessed with cars, meaning they like it. And the actual definitions for obsessions with OCD is that they are intrusive thoughts, images, or urges. And by intrusive, meaning they are unwelcome, they're unwanted, they're persistent, they're distressing. So these kind of obsessions, they're not enjoyable. They're not things we want to think about, but it might be a thought that pops into our head. And then because we give it meaning, we're like, why did I have that? What does this mean? Does this mean I'm going to do it? It continues to be persistent and cause more distress. So that's the obsessive part of it. And I should say that everybody has intrusive thoughts. They may not have obsessions. Every human being has intrusive thoughts, just those random things that pop in your head. And you're like, well, where did that come from? Why did I have that? So then the compulsive part, compulsions are those repetitive rituals. And it might be a behavioral ritual or it could be a mental ritual. And they are the things we do. We have the strong urge or this need to perform this ritual to either decrease the anxiety from the obsessions or to decrease just the obsessions themselves, hoping to make the thought go away. So most people are aware of the physical compulsions, things like excessive hand washing, flipping light switches on and off, checking locks. But there's also this category of mental compulsions, which are rituals we do in our head, feel like we have to do to make the thought go away. And this could look like counting, reviewing and ruminating, reassuring ourselves, anything that we do in our head over and over.
And so I want to talk specifically about bipolar. A lot of people struggle with it and we may not realize because there are so many misconceptions and not enough representation. And so can you start off just explaining diagnosis of bipolar 1 versus bipolar 2 in general, even though I'm sure it could look different for everyone?
Yeah, there's quite a spectrum of how bipolar disorder shows up. And most people are familiar with kind of the stereotype display that are like in movies or TVs of like really distinctive manic episodes where people are, you know, out spending money and having sex with lots of people. And sometimes those things are true. Like very manic or very depressed, but there's a really big spectrum of them. So for bipolar one, the difference as far as diagnosis is that with bipolar one, you don't have to have an experience of depression in order to be diagnosed. You can just have mania and be diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Bipolar two means that you must have had at least one experience of what would be major depressive disorder, along with hypomania or mania. And so there's also something called cyclothymia, which is like bipolar disorder, but less intensive mood swings.
That's so fascinating because I think when so many people think of ADHD, they focus on schooling and the learning situation for kids, but we don't always talk about how it affects relationships and other areas of our life. So can you talk about some examples of how ADHD can affect relationships in general that we may not be aware of?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of like making a bottom line about things. Sometimes it kind of keeps it simple, but you know, when you think about the ability to sustain a relationship, to stay connected to people, and then to continue to grow, kind of the basic requirement is the ability to pay attention. both to yourself and to the other person. And so people with ADHD, it's not like they're deliberately not paying attention to things. It's actually like neurologically an inability to sustain attention. So they can turn towards something and pay attention, but their brain pulls them away before the thing has finished. And then there is this constant battle to go back and forth. And if you know you have ADHD, you might even just be aware of that process. Or you might not, because a lot of people don't even know that that's an ADHD thing, right? They just know they were told they have ADHD. The doctor gave them medication. No one actually showed how these symptoms show up in your life. So if you can't pay attention to how somebody is affected, somebody's social cues, all these kinds of things, then you have no way of monitoring yourself, knowing what steps you need to take to move forward to do something differently, even gaining an understanding about like why something keeps tying your shoelaces together. You just feel confused and stuck all the time.
Yeah, that's such a great point too, because like different cultures obviously have different ways they express their emotions or feel comfortable discussing certain issues. Not every culture wants to say they're depressed. Maybe they say I've slept less or I've slept more, or they talk more about the symptoms. So I think it is important to realize that. And you did mention emotions and how it was not normal for you, or you weren't used to expressing your emotions with your culture. And I can relate to that in a sense, because my parents are immigrants and they came during the Iranian Revolution. And there is this level of resiliency. And I think, I don't know if you can relate to this, but guilt of, you know, wanting to be the best you can be because they've been through so much. And there are times where it's hard to express your emotions because they may have learned to suppress it or just be strong or get through what they need to and be resilient. So can you relate in any way to those feelings of guilt or, you know, just needing to push through because they did and you don't want to disappoint them in any way?
Right. I certainly can relate to that. I felt like I had to perform. They went through all those struggles, financial distress, you know, emotional grief, loss of grieving their country. And so it wasn't so conscious as a child, but I was always hearing messages, you got to do better than my generation. You have to go to college. You have to be successful in America. You can be successful. You don't need a ton of money to go to college. You know, so I would constantly hear those messages. So I felt like, well, okay, I better do this because I don't want to disappoint my parents. And I think being the eldest daughter too, there was the sense of responsibility that I'm going to take care of them so they will be okay. So I could be a professional and help them out financially or help them understand things. And some of that is cultural, of course, but I also felt like more of a weight of responsibility to do that. And it wasn't very conscious till I was an adult, you know, trying to become a little bit more independent, like move out of the house or get married or have a baby. There was this guilt of like this pang of like, I need to still take care of my parents. And so some people don't understand that unless they're of a, you know, BIPOC or different cultural background than the dominant American, you know, culture here. So there was a lot of guilt-driven decisions made just to please my parents, but also to make them proud. That was the biggest thing.
I really appreciate you sharing that. And you gave the great example of seeing mental health in such extremes. And I think there is that misconception of, I mean, if you're going to work, if you're getting up every day, there's no way you're depressed. If you're doing things, you can't be anxious or be struggling. And I think a lot of people assume that you can only be struggling with mental health if it's obvious from the outside. And that does create a lot of shame. So I wanted to ask you if you notice, just even with those messages you grew up with or you notice in the Asian American community, for example, is there a common theme or some ways that you've noticed your clients feel growing up with those messages? Is there shame? What are some examples?
I think shame is a very prominent aspect of understanding your mental health, especially when we've been taught that emotions are kind of not helpful or disruptive, right? And so I think that in cultures in which there is a value placed around harmony or not disrupting, right, what is feels peaceful or calm, then so much lives underneath the surface, right? And I think I talk to about this a lot with my colleagues or other Asian American friends. We always say there's so much left unsaid in Asian culture, right? It's things that bubble underneath the surface, but we can't be direct about it. We can't say, hey, when you did this, it made me angry and it was hurtful, right? And so when we suppress that emotional content, we either bypass ourselves and say, oh, I'm being too sensitive, right? I'm making too big of a deal about it. Or we actually miss out on the knowledge that the emotion is trying to tell us, right? So we end up putting ourselves back in the same situations that make us upset. And we feel as though we can't change those situations because we can't bring those to the surface and try to change the dynamic. And so I think the shame, the cultural value of saving face is very prominent within Asian culture, right? This idea that I am not only a representation of myself, but I'm a representation of my parents and their parenting, and then my culture and my community, that I stand in a way to either honor or dishonor my people or my family. And I think that then creates that shroud of secrecy because we don't want to admit when we're struggling or admit fault because it could bring shame not only to ourselves, but the people we care about most.
Yeah.
So with your practice and the more you've learned about anxiety and studied psychology, are there any misconceptions that you hear about anxiety or, you know, invalidations that people hear often when it comes to anxiety? Because I feel like unless you're really experiencing it, you may think like, oh, well, everyone has anxiety.
So, you know, I think the famous one that everybody, you know, always says, is just like, just stop feeling anxious, stop thinking about that, you know, and it's not so easy, right? Like I even saw you shake your head because I think you can relate to that and understand that. And so it's not something that people can necessarily control happening to them. They can, of course, utilize coping skills and do different things to manage the anxiety when it comes up. But there are just some people who have a proclivity to being anxious, whether we can go into like a whole nature nurture type of, you know, discussion about where that comes from. But some people are just more anxious in their nature. And it is not something that they can easily turn off or turn on. And so I think for a lot of people, people don't understand that people aren't, they're not being dramatic or they're not making it up or they're not trying to get some kind of secondary need met. They're really just anxious.
And you mentioned growing up in a religious household and how it was like talked about to just pray it away when it comes to mental health. And I think that's very common. And I think there's also that misconception that like faith and mental health and religion have to be like complete opposites when I personally believe that they can intertwine and coexist. So what are your thoughts for someone who's maybe struggling to have a relationship with their religion or their faith specifically while working on their mental health and maybe realizing that they can also have faith while seeking support, while taking medication, whatever it may be?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it doesn't have to be either or, it can be both and that's the message I try to often give to, you know, whoever I'm working with or everyone I'm talking to about therapy and our spirituality and whatever that may look like, is that it doesn't have to be either or, it can be both and it can be even be intertwined, right? Particularly when you're getting providers that understand kind of the complexities and that we believe in our faith and what that looks like and how they can interweave the work that we're doing as therapists that better support you and utilize that as an asset, right? I don't think, you know, having belief in faith is something that, as in particularly in therapy, that we, you know, we cancel out. I feel like it can't be utilized, or it's, you know, it's either or, right? Again, it's that both end. So there's part of your faith that can actually serve as an asset. We can utilize that in our treatment plan and how we work with our clients to really help them get to where they want to be, utilizing that very important part of their life to get them there.
And like you said, in especially American culture, there's so much emphasis on what's going on externally, what's like our accomplishments, did we get the house, are we married, like all those things that I think there's sometimes that assumption of like, if everything's going on great, like outside, you should be fine. You should feel good about it. Like your internal experience somehow needs to match that. And so what would you tell to anyone who maybe feels that sense of shame or confusion, thinking like, well, everything, you know, I got that promotion. I'm really like, I have a great partner or my friends are great. I don't feel good though about it. And I feel like I should. And there's that level of shame or just feeling bad about it.
Yeah. Here's what I would say. And I have no idea if this will actually make people feel better or not, but I still think it's correct answer. So that's where I'm going to start. And it gets a little like metaphysical. So bear with me here, but everything you just described, you know, a partner, a job, a safe place to live, enough money in the bank, having cool stuff, having family support, every single one of those things at the end of the day is an external factor. And anything that is outside of yourself is ultimately just a stimuli. And so a stimuli has a potential to make you feel something, but there's no guarantee that it will. There's a lot of things that can get in the way of us having good things in our lives and us feeling good about the things we have. One, I mean, the most simple one is, do you pay attention to it? Because it's really easy for us to even people who don't struggle with depression and anxiety face this to some degree, it's really easy for us to hyper-focus on the negative. We look at, where am I falling short in life? Where am I the farthest away from my goals? What are my biggest weaknesses as a person? What are my biggest failures? We tend to put way more emphasis on those things than our successes, our victories, our achievements, our accomplishments. And so it's really easy for us to end up with a skewed sense of who we are and how we're doing. Even if that's not the case, even if you're very aware, like I have all these wonderful things in my life, I am blessed, I am successful, I am loved. In order for those to make you feel anything, a complicated series of chemical reactions has to occur in your brain involving transmission of dopamine and serotonin and probably some other things we don't even fully understand yet. And when you're in the midst of a spike of anxiety or a depressive episode, those messages, because that's all anything outside of you is, it's a message. It's a message that has to get a certain ways in to make you feel anything. And it doesn't always get all the way in. And so you can be logically aware of it, consciously grateful of it, objectively able to identify, I have a pretty good life. And that does not guarantee you will feel anything from it. And further, that doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. That's where I think a lot of the shame and self-stigma comes from, is when we know that we have some pretty good things going for us. We know that we have things that, quote, should make us feel some certain way, and we don't feel that way. It's really easy for us to blame ourselves for that. And we'll say, I'm so ungrateful. You know, how dare I? There's people, you know, in war-torn third world countries, there's people who are starving, there's people who are being martyred, and I'm out here sad because I don't have enough friends. But that's not how it works. It's not how brains work. We do not just automatically experience a set of emotions based on the objective quality of our lives. Those inner reactions still have to take place, and they have to take place fully for us to experience the emotional reaction that we, quote, should have from these things. And when depression or anxiety or anything gets in the way of those messages completing their pathways, you could have literally the best life in the world and be miserable. And I mean, I know that's a hard thing to define, right? Who has the best life in the world? But There's a flip side to the I'm so ungrateful, look at the third world countries kind of thing, which is that you can also probably find examples of people who have even more of the things that you think you should feel grateful for than you do. People who have more success, more money, more fame than you. And many of those people are still struggling with their mental health, are still struggling to feel good about who they are or their life. So make sure you look at both directions. Otherwise, you just basically end up feeling like I'm pretty much the worst person in the world for not being able to appreciate these things. And it solidifies the point that we don't just experience some certain level of happiness because of the objective quality of our lives. That, don't get me wrong, I wish that's how it worked. I'd always be happy if that was true, because my life objectively is awesome, but I don't always feel it because my brain doesn't always cooperate with the things I want it to do. And that's just the reality of living with chronic mental health conditions.
Thank you all so much for tuning in. Once again, if you want to listen to the full episodes, know which episode it was that you were listening to, you can visit the show notes of this episode, where I will include the names, the titles, and the guests that were on the show. And you can listen again if you already have, or tune in if it's your first time. And as always, you can find me at Trust and Thrive on Instagram and TikTok. And that being said, I hope you take care of yourself this week, especially the first week of Mental Health Awareness Month, which it always is in my eyes. And we will be back with a new episode next Thrive Thursday.